Good afternoon, Patriots. This is the American Vision broadcast on the TLB-TV network and brought to you by the Liberty Beacon Project. I'm your host, Bill Muckler, and I'm coming to you today from my home in Cocoa, Florida. You can look and see over my shoulder the Indian River. And I'm super excited today. Boys and girls, we got a special treat for us. We have an author, Steve Snyder, who's just going to tell you some most fascinating story about him and his dad. And so, Steve, I want to welcome you to the American Vision.
Well, thank you very much, Bill. It's great to be with you.
And Steve, could you tell us where you're broadcasting from? And because we all do this from our home studio, so to say, and a little bit about yourself.
Okay. Well, I live in Seal Beach, California, which is in Orange County. It's about 40 miles south of Los Angeles. I've lived here since 1972. I was actually born in Pasadena, California, and grew up in the neighboring community of San Marino. It's interesting to note that the first mayor of San Marino was George Patton, General George Patton's father. So there's some military history there. I went through the school districts there, and then I went to college at UCLA, graduated. I was in the same class as Lew Alcindor, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, the heydays of UCLA basketball. And then I went to work, had several jobs, but my main career was with Vision Service Plan, VSP, which provides vision care as an employee benefit that corporations offer their employees to furnish eye exams, glasses, and contact lenses. I was with them for 36 years in sales and sales management, and then finally retired in 2009. So as I said, I live here in Seal Beach, been married to my wife, Glenda, for 33 years. We have three grown boys. We have a second home in Sedona, Arizona, that we so we kind of go back and forth between the high desert of Arizona and Seal Beach.
Wow, great. Hey, and I want to tell all the viewers that I first came across Steve about a year ago when I found his book, and I got it for my Kindle. I bought the ebook, and I read it, and I was just fascinated by the book, and I had no idea who Steve was at the time until I read the book, and I was really in awe. And I have such great admiration and respect for Steve's father, although I've never met him before. After reading the book, Shotdown, I was really happy that I was able to find Steve, and we got together, and really looking forward to this. So, Steve, why don't you tell us a little bit about your father and why you wrote the book? And I'm going to also show the book on here, and I'll just move to the side a little bit.
Okay, well, I had a great relationship with my dad. He was a great man. He was a big man, 6'3", kind of a no-nonsense type guy, but he was a real loving father. My two sisters and I, we always kind of compared him to John Wayne, or if you were familiar with the old TV series Gunsmoke, James Arness.
Absolutely.
He was kind of that type of individual, but we were very close. You know, he coached my little league teams growing up. We'd go to football games together. And so we had a real good relationship.
That's fantastic. And the reason you had the great relationship with him and you actually had your dad was because of the people who he found and found him in World War II back in, I guess he was shot down, what, in 1944, was it?
Or yes, 43? On February 8th of 44.
February of 1944, yeah. I'm trying to recall the book, and I tried to go back and read some passages. What gave you the idea that you wanted to, in a sense, memorialize your father and his crew?
Well, I was always interested in World War II, you know, growing up. I was born in 1947, you know, a few years after the war ended. And that time there were all these books about the war and TV series about the war and movies. And I just kind of got hooked. You had Play Army and things like that. And growing up, I knew the basics of my dad's World War II history. And I knew he was a B-17 pilot. He was stationed in England with the 8th Air Force and flew high-altitude daylight precision bombing missions over occupied Europe and Germany. And then, as you said, he was shot down over Belgium in 1944. But fortunately for me, like you alluded to, he evaded capture and made it back home. But it wasn't until I retired in 2009 that I really had the time to delve into his war history in more detail. My parents had kept a lot of material from the war years that I wanted to go through and organize. And it was not my intention at all at that time to write a book. I just wanted to learn more. And there were two items that were really significant. One was a diary that my dad wrote while he was missing in action about his plane being shot down. And it was absolutely riveting. So much so that it was included in two books that had been written, The Mighty Eighth by Gerald Astor and First Over Germany by Russell Strong. And the other item were all the letters that my dad had written to my mother while he was stationed in England, and reading those were absolutely fascinating. He was very candid in what he wrote to my mother. He talked about bombing missions, what life was like on the base, what life was like in London and England at the time, some of the escapades he and his crew had, why they were stationed there. And I just became hooked. It became my passion. And I started reading book after book about the air war over Europe. I went on the internet and spent countless declassified military documents. I joined a number of World War II organizations, started going to their reunions and listening to veterans tell their stories. In fact, today I'm on the board of directors. I'm immediate past president of the 306 Bomb Group Historical Association, which my dad was a member of. And then finally, in 2012, I just finally came to the conclusion that the story of my dad and his crew was so unique and so compelling that it needed to be told and people needed to know about it. So I decided to write a book.
And thankfully you did. And all of us that have read the book or have the opportunity to read the book, and I hope that the people who are viewing today will go ahead and get your book, either a print copy or an ebook, so they can learn about this fantastic story. Now, as you were talking, I got thinking about you. You mentioned the 8th Air Force, and wasn't the 8th Air Force the subject of the movie and the TV series 12 O'Clock High?
Yes. The movie was actually based on a true story about the 306th Bomb Group that my dad was in. Mm-hmm. The fictitious bomb group in the movie, the Night 18th, was derived by multiplying the 306th by three. That's how they came up with that. So that was actually about the group my dad was with. It was based the movie earlier before my dad arrived in England with the 306. And then the TV series that showed for, oh gosh, I think if I remember correctly, maybe 3 years, 2 or 3 years.
I know I was a fan of the TV series. In fact, I watched every episode, and as I recall, there were a lot of great actors, and I think Robert Lansing was maybe one of the well-known and key guys for a while. But they're actually showing the 12 O'Clock High TV series on a channel called MeTV. That's a memorable TV where they show all the old black and white TV series, you know, like 12 O'Clock High, and they show Combat, if you remember that one.
Oh, yeah.
And, of course, things like Perry Mason and things like that. But anyway, in your book, you talk about your father's life and experiences in England and then also in Denmark, Belgium. So Tell a little bit about your dad and his flying, and maybe what I can do is I've got some scenes here. So these guys were real heroes. They went on these bombing runs, and you know they weren't in the trenches, but boy, they were in constant danger, and it wasn't very comfortable being up in those things either.
Oh, yes. Flying combat missions in the 8th Air Force was actually the most dangerous and hazardous duty assignment in the United States military during World War II. 26,000 men of the 8th Air Force died, which was more than the entire Marine Corps fighting in the Pacific. Amazing. And another 28,000 men of the 8th Air Force became prisoners of war after their planes, their bombers were knocked out of the sky by either German anti-aircraft fire or German fighter planes. So it was hazardous from the moment they took off to the moment they landed.
Wow, I didn't know those statistics. So what you're talking about is more than 50,000 airmen, and that was the Army Air Corps at the time. It was the forerunner of the United States Air Force. And a lot of people don't understand that. I think it was 1947. That would have been about the time you were born that the Army Air Corps became the United States Air Force.
Yeah, it was on September 18th, if I remember correctly, in 1947, the year I was born. I was born in April, so it was a little after.
Wow.
The Air Force actually became its own separate entity of the U.S. military.
So I'm really a student of Marine Corps history because of my service in the United States Marine Corps. And, for example, in Iwo Jima, we lost more than 5,000 Marines and about 25,000, and I'm just giving round numbers here, wounded in action. So we're talking about 30,000, and almost twice that many were either killed or shot down or something happened to them in World War II. So I didn't realize how I knew it was dangerous, but I didn't realize how severe it was.
Yeah, it was really tough duty. At the beginning of the war, there was no mission limit. The guys would just fly, and it didn't take them long to realize that they would never get back home. They would either die or be shot down and become prisoners of war. And the morale just went in the tank. And then finally, in the spring of 1943, they implemented a mission limit of 25 combat missions, and then you could go home. Actually, the flight surgeon, Dr. Thurman Schuller of the 306 Bomb Group, was responsible for convincing the 8th Bomber Command, General Ira Eaker, to implement that 25 mission limit. But even with the 25 mission limit, it was statistically impossible for combat crewmen to complete 25 missions. The casualty rate, your chances of coming back was only 1 out of 4. So still they faced unbelievably odds, tough odds in 1943.
And I think what a lot of people don't understand, and I know I was born in 1935, so I grew up during World War II, and what people don't understand is we never really had much of an air power until the 1930s, I guess it was. And so what they were doing here is they were really breaking new ground, so to say, and starting a new way of conducting the war by actually flying these bombing missions. Now, we've all seen movies and read stories about World War One and the pilots in the French escadrille, I think they were called, and the Red Baron and dogfights and everything. But that really wasn't a key part of the conflict like it was in World War Two. So, you know, people like your dad were really, they were the forerunners of all this, who knew modern warfare.
Yeah, like you say, we didn't have really much at all of an air force. All these pilots, you know, they weren't, most of these guys weren't trained pilots. They were just guys that were volunteered to go into the air force. It was all volunteer. Mm-hmm. And so they were just put in these trainers, got a little training, and then sent right into combat. It's not like you had a trained group of pilots and then they went to war. Like the old expression, you know, civilian soldiers or citizen soldiers.
Now, tell us a little bit about when they're up in the air, and I'm going to show a picture of what a B-17 looks like. It's kind of a cross section, and it shows the 10 crew members. And, you know, tell us a little bit about the altitudes they flew. They needed oxygen, the comforts of the B-17, or should I say the discomforts of it. and where all these crew members were located.
Okay. Well, B-17, it was nicknamed the Flying Fortress because of the armament that they carried on the plane. They had 12 to 13 50 caliber machine guns that could put out a tremendous amount of firepower. And the B-17 could also take a tremendous amount of battle damage and continue flying. They were incredible aircraft, and it was designed by the Boeing company. And about 64% of the B-17s were produced by Boeing, but then another 18% was produced by Lockheed Vega, and another 18% by the Douglas Aircraft Company. But as you mentioned, they had a 10-man crew. They had four officers. They had the lead pilot, who my dad was the first pilot, and as such, the commander of the plane and the crew. And then to his right, you had the co-pilot. And then the other two officers were in the nose of the plane, the plexiglass nose of the plane, the bombardier and the navigator. And then the other six men were enlisted non-commissioned officers who were predominantly gunners. Mm-hmm. And as I mentioned, it was dangerous from the time they took off to the time they landed. First of all, at the height of the war, there were about 40 bomb groups in England. And on the day of a mission, there'd be hundreds of planes taking off from these bases that were only located about 5 to 10 miles apart. And back then, you had no air traffic control, no radar. It was all based on visual sight. And usually the weather was kind of cruddy in England. It's all overcast, socked in, and you really couldn't see anything until you got above the cloud layer. So mid-air collisions were not uncommon. Then they had to form up, which took about an hour to 2 hours, because individual planes had to form up into three plane elements into bomb squadrons into bomb groups into bomb wings into air divisions. And so, I mean, that, as I said, took quite a bit of time before they could even head across the English Channel to begin their mission. And then, as you alluded to, they had to deal with the elements. These planes weren't pressurized, so above 10,000 feet, they had to go on oxygen, or else they'd pass out and you know, in a few minutes be dead. And it was extremely cold at that altitude. It was minus 40 to 60 degrees below zero. So frostbite was a huge problem. There are many airmen that were hospitalized for a lengthy period of time because of their serious frostbite injuries. And then they had to deal with the German aircraft, or the Air Force, which is called the Luftwaffe. Mm-hmm. The Germans had radar stations along the continental coast of Europe, so they knew when these bomber formations were coming over, and they'd send their fighter planes up to attack them. And at the beginning of the war, it was 8th Bomber Command's belief that these heavily armed bombers flying in these tight formations, they call them combat box formations, of hundreds of planes would be able to defend themselves with all. But unfortunately, that was not the case. These bombers could not defend themselves from the Luftwaffe. And they took just horrendous, devastating losses into 42 and especially into 43. And finally, Bomber Command realized that they needed fighter escorts to help protect them from those German fighters. But initially, the problem was that these fighters didn't have the fuel capacity to escort the bombers deep into Germany. They could cross the channel and get into continental coastways, but then they'd have to turn around and go back to England. Well, the German fighter planes would just wait until those U.S. fighters would go turn around, and then they'd swoop on those bombers. It wasn't until the end of 44 when the P-47 Thunderbolts got external fuel tanks and the introduction of the P-51 Mustang that these bomber formations finally had escort all the way to the target and back. And the P-51s were especially affected. They basically wiped out the Luftwaffe by the time D-Day came around on June 6th of 44. But the other thing they had to deal with on those bombing missions was anti-aircraft fire. The German word for anti-aircraft defense cannon was called, I can't even pronounce it, but the abbreviation was FLAC. Mm-hmm. And they were extremely deadly weapons. They could fire shells 20 a minute, and these shells were filled with all sorts of and shapes and sizes of metal, razor sharp metal called shrapnel. And so when these shells exploded, those shrapnel would burst out hundreds of feet and could easily penetrate the thin aluminum skin of these bombers. So they had to deal with that. And these bombers, when they'd come to the target and start their bomb run, they'd have to fly just straight and level and could not take any evasive action, have to fly right into that curtain of death. And if a shell hit the bomber, you know, directly, it would just basically explode and the bomber would disappear. If it hit a wing, the bomber would drop like a stone. So it was what those guys had to go through on these missions was something else.
Yeah, I can recall the P-51s, and as young kids, we were all excited about that. That, you know, we had this great fighter and everything, but the fighters could only take them so far, because once they got into their bombing run, then the fighters couldn't protect them anymore, because they were subjected to the German anti-aircraft, or, you know, the flak. And I think we've probably all seen some movies where we see, you know, the flak exploding, you see these big black clouds, and they were just filled with, like you said, razor sharp shrapnel that was just flying in every direction. So, and they, like you say, they had to be at a certain altitude. Do you recall what their altitude was when they were on the bombing runs?
Well, it varied, but I, you know, typically around 25,000 feet.
At 25,000 feet, and you're talking about 50 to 60 degrees below zero. And if anybody remembers anything, has seen any of these B-17 Flying Fortresses, they had like two side gunners, and that was open. I mean, you know, there was no window there to protect them from the wind and the cold, was there?
Well, it depended on the model. There were actually three different B-17 models flown in Europe. Initially, it was the E model, but there were only about 500 of those made, so they were quickly replaced by the F models. And on the F models, the waist gunner windows were open, and so the wind would just come howling in there. On the later model, which was the definitive B-17, really was the G model, which could be distinguished by the chin turret under the nose. And on the G model, the windows did have plexiglass. On them.
Now, one thing that would really bother me is I'm a little bit claustrophobic sometimes when I get into tight places. What I can't understand is how the tail gunner and the bottom of the airplane?
Ball turret gunner.
The ball turret gunner, yes. I mean, these guys were in cramped spaces for hours, and there was no heat there.
Well, the missions, they varied in length from anywhere from 6 to 10 hours. And as you said, the most cramped position on the plane was the ball turret gunner, because he had, after the planes took off, he climbed into that little plexiglass ball under the belly of the plane. And he was basically in a fetal position, you know, for hours, as you said. And also the tail gunner was in a very cramped position. So very uncomfortable. And they had all this bulky gear, you know, that they wore. They kind of looked like the Michelin Man up there. They had so much, you know, clothing on, trying to keep them warm. So it was very uncomfortable. For a person who's never been inside a B-17, you really don't realize how cramped and small those planes were. They seem big, and at the time they were big. But if anyone has an opportunity to go through a B-17, because there's a number of B-17s that tour around the country, they should do so, and you really get a better feel for what it was like inside that plane.
Okay. So let's move this a little bit forward and tell us about the mission when your father was shot down, and because that's the name of the book, and some of his escapades, some of his ordeals, I guess you might say, of trying to elude and escape from the enemy and the people that helped him. And I'm going to put up a picture of some of the crew. There were 10 in the crew, and I took this photo from the book, and I guess your father is, as I'm seeing this, is on the, and I'm looking at this backwards, so I see him on one end and three other crew members.
Yeah, he's in the dark blue shirt with blue pants.
Which, as the viewers are watching, it would be on their right.
Yes.
Because I'm seeing this backwards.
Yeah, and I'll explain that picture in a few minutes.
Okay, great.
Basically, the first half of the book builds up to the day that the plane was shot down, and the second half of the book is all about what happened after they were shot down. It was on a mission to Frankfurt, Germany on February 8th of 1944, where my dad, the plane dropped their bomb successfully, and they were going to try to head back to England, but their bomb bay doors had been hit by flak, and they couldn't get the doors back up. And that caused a drag on the plane. They lost airspeed, and they fell behind the formation of the other B-17s heading back. And they were singled out by two German Focke-Wulf fighter planes, one piloted by Siegfried Merck, and the other piloted by Hans Berger. Mm. And in the ensuing air battle, the Susan Ruth was shot down. Two of the crew were killed in the plane. The other eight were able to bail out successfully. But both those German Focke-Wulf fighters were shot down as well. Hans Merck was killed in his plane. It crashed in Belgium. And the other pilot, Hans Berger, he was shot down by the gunners on my dad's plane, and he was able to bail out and make it through the war. And one of the most fantastic things of my whole experience of writing this book is that I found Hans Berger and interviewed him for the book. And I owe it all to my wife, because when I was initially doing my research, it didn't even dawn on me to try to find the pilot, because I thought odds were he died in the war, because most of those German pilots did, because they had no mission limits. And if he did survive the war, it was 70 years later, there was a good chance that he had passed on. And then even if he was alive, I couldn't speak German. Well, not only did Hans survive the war, and he's still living today, he's 94. He became a translator after the war, so he speaks perfect English. And so for the book, I interviewed him over the email and over the telephone, and he gave me some wonderful insight about what it was like to go up against the 8th Air Force that's in the book. And Hans and I have become good friends. I went and visited him in 2016 and filmed an interview with him. I'm in the process of making a documentary, which will hopefully be out maybe, probably not until next year, about the book, but that interview will be part of that. So I digress a little bit there, but unbelievable.
I'm glad you talked about Hans Berger, because I remember him in the book. And isn't that fascinating about how, you know, the countries were at war, but yet all the individuals, your dad, Hans Berger, all of them, they were just guys who got caught up in this mess. And it's just fantastic that you were able to get in touch with them. But then I want to get back to now your father's plane was damaged and fell behind, and we know what happens there when they fall behind, and then pick it up from there.
Okay, the German fighters were firing 20 millimeter ammunition at the planes, and they pretty much destroyed the plane. It caught on fire, and there was no way my dad could save the plane, and so he told everyone to bail out. You know, being in the nose of the plane or in the front of the plane, he didn't, with the fire was behind him, he didn't know what happened to the guys in the back of the plane. He didn't even know at the time that two of his crewmen were killed. And as I mentioned, the other eight were able to bail out, and they came out in different places. Actually, the plane and my dad both came down in Belgium. But the other guys that were bailed out came down in France. So this was right at the French-Belgian border. And then various things happened to each member of the crew. Some became prisoners of war. my dad, after he bailed out, his parachute came down and got caught up in these trees, and he was hanging 20 feet off the ground and he couldn't get down. Fortunately for him, a couple of young Belgian farmers saw his plight and came to his rescue. They went back to the farmhouse, got a ladder and some rope, and helped him get down the trees. And it was early afternoon when the plane was shot down. So it was daylight, and they told him just to stay put and hide. It was too dangerous to try to move him at that time because there was all these German patrols combing the area. And so they came back that night and got him and took him to one of the farmers, Raymond Dervan is the name of the young farmer, to his parents' farmhouse. And he stayed there one night because they thought it was too dangerous for him to stay there any longer than that with those German patrols in that area. So Belgium customs officer Paul Tilquin came on a tandem bike and picked him up that night. And they headed off in the middle of the night, pitch black. It was raining. My dad had shrapnel wounds in his legs. All the guys had wounds to some degree or another. Some extremely serious, but my dad, he could only pedal with one leg because the other was hurting. And they came to a hill, and they couldn't ride the bike any up the hill. It was too steep, so they got up and started walking it up. And when they got to the top of the hill, there was a cabaret or a little cafe there. The lights were on, music was playing. They could hear people talking, laughing. All of a sudden, two German Luftwaffe officers come out with their arms around young girls, and one of them comes up to my dad and asks him for a light for a cigarette. My dad's petrified. He can't speak English or French, but fortunately, Paul Tilquin could, and then gave him a light, and the German officers let him go on their way. I guess they were too inebriated and too interested in their girlfriends to pay much attention to these two guys walking a bike up the hill. So that was one of the adventures he had, but he had many. After that, he was moved from house to house, being hidden by the Belgium underground. How long he stayed in any house depended on how brave the people were who lived there, and also how dangerous the Belgium underground thought it was for him to stay there. He might stay in a house for one night. He might stay there for 6 weeks. And so they moved him around. And in the book, there's several instances described where he was almost discovered. And finally, though, after a few months, he got tired of hiding. So he decided to join the French resistance and start fighting on the ground against the Germans. Actually, before he went into the Air Force, he had gone into the Army. And he was in the infantry and trained in the infantry for a year before he actually went into the Air Force. So he had experience of fighting on the ground. Which is, I can't believe he did that, because he went from being hidden to risking his life fighting against the Germans. I don't know how many people, I don't know if I could have done that, to have the guts to go fight against the Germans, because he hooked up with this French resistance called the Maquis, which is, the Maquis was made up of small guerrilla groups all over France. There were about 20 guys in his group, and you know, they're all foreigners. They were made up of Belgians, Frenchmen, Algerians. So he's joining this group that he doesn't know any of these guys from Adam. He could speak a little conversational French by then, but you know, it's still, the communication isn't all that good. And so he ended up fighting with the resistance until finally, after D-Day, when Patton's 30th Army came up through France after D-Day, my dad hooked up with them and then made it back to England.
Well, there's no question in reading the book that your father, Howard Snyder, was an extraordinary man, an extraordinary individual. So I guess back in those days, you know, they were all about, you know, what they were going to be able to do to win the war. That's all they thought about. And they were willing to make great sacrifices. Unfortunately, people today don't seem to understand that as much as they did then. I guess that's why they were called the greatest generation. But anyway, so then he actually was involved in that. And then tell us about how, I guess it was when around April or May of 45. So he was there for more than a year. when the war was over and they were liberated?
Well, not quite. He was missing in action for 7 months from the time that he bailed out, from the time that he made it back to England. And I should have mentioned this earlier, but his plane was named the Susan Ruth after my oldest sister, who was 1 year old at the time that he went overseas. And then my other sister, his daughter, Nancy, was born while he was missing in action. So you can imagine how tough that was on my mother, who was back in California with a one-year-old daughter and an infant daughter, you know, not knowing if her husband was dead or alive for 7 months. It wasn't until he got back to England and sent her a telegram that she knew that he was alive. But it was, and during that time, it was really hard, and the relatives, whether it's the wives or girlfriends or mothers or fathers or those guys that were missing in action, that didn't know whether they where they were or whether they were well or not. And there's lots of excerpts in the from letters that are in the book between relatives praying for the safety and lives of their loved ones.
Steve, introduce the brave heroes that are in the photo that I have up there.
Okay. As we mentioned before, there were 10 members of a B-17 crew. Two of my dad's crew died in the plane. The eight bailed out, but three of those men who successfully bailed out evaded capture for a couple months, but were eventually captured by the Germans and killed. So only five of my dad's crew made it back. Five of them did not. And this picture was taken in 1989. There was a man, Paul Delahaye, that created the Belgium American Foundation there in Belgium, in southern Belgium, to honor and remember the Americans and the Allies who came to rescue them from Nazi occupation. And he had built a number of memorials in the area. And in 1989, they built a memorial to the crew of the Susan Ruth. And the four remaining crewmen went back for the dedication of the monument. The fifth man who actually made it back from the war, Richard Daniels, the bombardier, had died prior to that. But here you see the four crewmen that came back with their wives for the dedication. As you look on the right is my father, Howard Snyder, the pilot. And then in the white jacket is Roy Holbert, who was the flight engineer, top turret gunner. Then you have Bill Schlenker, who was the tail gunner. And he actually, well, let me go back to Roy. Roy, he was captured immediately after bailing out. And he spent the entire remainder of the war as a POW. He wasn't liberated until April of 1945. So he endured lots of trials. He was involved in the infamous 86-day death march, which is a whole story in itself. Bill Schlenker in the blue jacket, the dark jacket and the blue shirt, the tail gunner, he also evaded capture. He was sheltered by one family, as opposed to my dad that was moved all over the place. Bill stayed with one family, the Calais family, in Chimay, Belgium. But my dad and he didn't have any idea where the other one was. So he evaded capture, then made it back. And then the last gentleman is waist gunner Joe Musial. He actually, when the German fighters attacked the plane, had his foot blown off. And bailed out. He's helped another crewman bail out here with you know, his foot just dangling from a tendon. They actually amputated it, the Germans did, when he went to a hospital, but it was basically blown off in the plane. He became a detective in the Miami Police Department after the war. So those men, they were given plates. They're holding plates from the community of Momigny, which is in southern Belgium. They were honored at the dedication of the memorial.
When you mentioned Joe Musial, we have a connection there because I'm sure you've met him and talked with him. I knew one of his relatives, I guess it was a cousin or maybe a nephew, was Stan Musial of the St. Louis Cardinals, because they were from that area of southwestern Pennsylvania.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. He actually enlisted in Pennsylvania.
Yeah.
He had a good story. He and Richard Daniels, who had died before the dedication of the memorial, their injuries were so serious that they were repatriated back to the U.S. before the end of the war. They were treated in hospitals, but they were sent back in an exchange of prisoners. And he came back into New Jersey to the, I think it was the Halloran Hospital, where he met a volunteer there, Eleanor, and they ended up getting married. That was a nice little story.
Yeah. And when I talked about Stan Musial, his son went to the same high school I went to, but was a little bit younger. And my parents were heavily involved in the Mothers and Fathers Club of this high school. It was an all boys Catholic junior ROTC school, Army ROTC school, and called Christian Brothers College High School in St. Louis. And so parents got to know Stan and Lil very well. But Stan even went into the war, into the Navy, and missed his last season of the war while he was gone. So he lost a whole year of his career in the war. So these were really extraordinary people who did extraordinary things. And I'm so proud of you and admire you so much and respect you so much for honoring your father, and really in doing so, you honored all of the people, all of these guys, and we're talking about more than 50,000 that were either killed or, you know, shot down or injured or something. But there was hundreds of thousands of others that flew these dangerous missions.
Oh, absolutely. I agree with you 100%. You know, that in my mind, these guys were the greatest generation. When I first started writing the book, I thought, well, I'm going to be writing a story about my dad. But then I quickly learned, well, no, it's not a story about my dad. It's a story about his whole crew, all the men who fought with the 306 mm-hmm. bomb group, all the men who served in the 8th Air Force, and really to an extent, all the men who served in World War II. There was no other event that affected more people than World War II. 60 million people died during the war. It changed the course of the U.S. and the world forever. So these guys who fought and died for freedom, their sacrifice can never be forgotten. And my little tagline or slogan is, it is our duty to remember.
Yeah, that's beautiful. And the way the book, you wrote the book, was just so fascinating to me, because you told the story of World War II and all these brave men and all their sacrifices, and you sort of told it through your father, his experiences and his eyes. So, I mean, that was just a way of putting a great human touch to the whole era of the early, you know, 1941 to 1945 and everything that everybody went through.
Yeah, when I was writing the book, I just didn't want it to be another war book, you know, for guys. Mm-hmm. I wanted it to appeal to the general population, you know, and be a story about, you know, the human spirits and about people. The story of my dad and his crew was all based on firsthand testimony by the people that were involved in the events that took place, either members of the crew, members of the Belgium underground, or declassified military documents. Really, what I added to the book was just a lot of information, historical information, and anecdotes about and surrounding the war to put it in context and give it background.
Okay, tell us now, because I don't know how much time we have left, but tell us now about some of the organizations you belong to and some of the things you're doing to honor these brave men.
I'd be glad to. Yeah, you know, I said I retired in 2009, but really, I work full time promoting my book. I'm on the internet every day promoting the book, and I do a lot of speaking, making PowerPoint presentations to all sorts of different organizations. I travel around the United States, attending lots of air shows, signing copies of my book. As I mentioned, I'm immediate past president of the 306 Bomb Group Historical Association. I'm a member of the Mighty 8 Air Force Museum down in Savannah, Georgia, Pooler, Georgia, actually. I go down there every year in February. I'll be going down there February 11th, coming up pretty soon to sign copies of my book. A member of the 8th Air Force Historical Society, a number of other World War II groups. But really, my passion is just tell the story of these guys and what they did and what they went through. And basically, the purpose of the 306 Bomb Group and the purpose of my presentations is threefold, is to remember, honor, and educate, to remember the guys that remember the air war over Europe, to honor the men who fought that air war, and to educate the public about it, especially younger generations.
Okay, there will be an article that accompanies this video, and this video will be on YouTube, and it'll be embedded in the article. And in the article, there's going to be a bio and a story about this, but also I've created links for you. And I want everybody to know that you have a web page. It's a great web page. I've gone through it and visited several times. And then also, Steve is on Facebook. He's on Twitter. So he's on social media like a lot of us are now. I think your email address is also available for people who want to write to you. And they can buy your book on Amazon, and I suspect other book sites. Can someone buy a book from you and get you to sign it for them?
Yes, my website is stevesnyderauthor.com, and if someone wants a signed copy of my book, you can go on the homepage of my website and just click on the Buy Now button and get an autographed book. You mentioned the TV series 12 O'Clock High. That's also every episode of that series is on my website. So if you want to check that out, and there's all sorts of archival films on my website, etc. But you can buy the book almost any place. I will mention, though, that in the print book, there's over 200 time period photographs of the people involved and the places where the action took place. In the ebook, formats only have 24 pictures. So I know people like reading on their Kindle or whatever, but you don't get quite all those pictures. Also, it's available as an audio book.
Yeah. And for example, I went through my Kindle, and I actually took photographs with my phone. And that's how I got these photos that you're seeing, like this one and this one. I did all this, I took this off your webpage. I found a way, I'm not very technically, but I found a way to copy that off your webpage and put it on there. And here's a picture of the author himself, with his flight jacket on. And that was another thing. These guys wore these leather jackets, and all of us young kids thought, oh, wow, look at that. To be able to wear a leather jacket like that as a pilot, they were truly our heroes. So anyway, Steve, I want to thank you for coming on the show. And I want to encourage everybody that sees this to get the book, buy the book, and get an autographed copy, a signed copy from Steve. I'm sure he'll be delighted to, sign a book and send it out to you.
Absolutely. Okay. It's my pleasure. I really appreciate the opportunity, Bill. It's been fun.
Okay. So I guess we're going to say goodbye, boys and girls, and I'll finish this off the way I always do and tell you that until next time, let's remember all the people who served our country the way Steve's father Howard did, and all those who are still serving today, all of our vets. And so God bless America. And God save our America, because we need you now more than ever before. Okay, Patriots, I'm back, and I hope you enjoyed the show with Steve Snyder and the story of his father, Howard, and all the brave men that flew with him and flew with our Air Forces and our Navy and Marine Corps pilots also during World War II. Anyway, I want to encourage you to get this book. I'm telling you, this book is a great read, and you won't go wrong with it. It's a page-turner. I read it in like a couple of nights. I couldn't put it down. I was just so fascinated by it. And, of course, all this is brought to you by my book also. And I used to hold it up for you, you know, and say, hey, buy the book. Now I with this new backdrop that I have, you can actually see the book on here. So I want you to buy the book. So really now, start reading books. Buy Shot Down and buy 2020 A Clear Vision for America. You're going to get two fantastic reads. And you can find Steve on social media and his webpage. You can find me on social media and my webpage. You can Google both of us, and we're both can be found on Google. So anyway, thanks a lot for watching the show. It's really been a pleasure, and I'm so delighted to have such a wonderful guest. And until next time, stay safe, everybody. I want to wish everybody a safe, prosperous, and joyous 2018. And as I always say, God save our America. We need you now more than ever before.